My name is Jen Ashburn. I am filling in for Chris, who is has family obligations tonight. So welcome to Hemingway. It's a great reading tonight. A lot of wonderful readers. I cannot fill Chris's philosophical shoes. He always has such thoughtful things to say about writing and poetry. And I can't do that, I don't feel, as he does that. But one thing I can do is share a poem that I love. And it is a poem that I think speaks to the reason we write and the reason we create art. So I will share that with you before I hand things over to Joan. But before I do that, I just want to give a big thanks to Herb and Hop Farms. Yes, let's give her a and remind you that we will be passing out the tip jar to please show your love. All right. So the poem I selected for tonight is by Maxine Skates. I came across this through a journal called Cave Wall. This is one of the first journals I ever submitted to, and they didn't publish me. But they sent my poems back. I actually send it through the mail, and they sent one of my poems back with like really detailed notes, which astounded me. And just for them to take that much care with my poem really made an impression. And so I thought, well, I'll buy a year's subscription, see what this journal's about. And I'm glad I did, because I came across one of those poems that really stuck with me, and it's become kind of a touchstone poem for me. It's by Maxine Skates, a West Coast poet, and it's called Singer. They listen to something they can't hear until they open their mouths, skinny whistler in a tuneless childhood where every scrape, every skinned knee, every door slammed on a spilled or misbegotten dream leans toward us cloaked in smoky bar light or circled in stage light. Amalia Rodriguez singing the losses of Fadu in a language we don't understand but can, because no one was happy there and neither were we. They tell us what we want to know and what we don't. Static popping, Bessie Smith singing to Clara Smith, singing it back. We don't know why we are here. They're not asking why. They're just saying that's how it is. Earth turning, their voices spinning a thread through the galaxy. Life going on, every stray dog howling at the moon. If they live long enough, if the car doesn't crash on a Mississippi back road, if Garland's last pill isn't one pill too many, their voices thicken, their vocal cords scar with the notes they keep reaching for, because they know we've been waiting, listening without knowing why we were listening until we heard them, our sirens, our chorus, their voices heard for the first time in the honeyed voice of someone we knew. The shot thrown back at the kitchen table, the lipstick on the rim of the glass, the first voice that told us sorrow was a well so deep we'd never hear the rock hitting water, that song, their song, never a song of ships so much as someone going away, a lament, never a song sung around fires, the one that keeps telling the endless march to victory, but the other song, Hecuba's wail, the song of junked cars and roofs tarped against rain, song of the broken branch we gave them, its fragrant blossoms asking, please sing why it's broken, sing why we broke it, why do these blossoms fade? Maxine Skates, everyone. All right. All right, and we're in for a great night, and I'll hand it over to Joan Bauer.
Thank you, Jen. Yay. Thank you, Jen. Yay. So we are really lucky to have such a great evening ahead of us. These are five really amazing poets and such strong voices and such really compelling work. And they don't all live here. Some of them had to do the big drive into Pittsburgh, and we really appreciate that. And a couple of them asked me not to read very much of their bios, but I'm going to read a little bit of their bios, just a couple of things. Even though I have to say there are some real tongue twisters in here, these poets have come up with real tongue twister titles. Our first poet this evening is Nikki Allen, and she does tell us she's a lover and a writer, and her work has appeared in Nailed, Crashed, Profane Journal, I love that, Profane Journal, and Encyclopedia Destructica, and it is great to have her back in Pittsburgh. Please welcome Nikki Allen.
Can you guys hear me okay? Is that too loud or?
It's not like, all right.
I'm glad it's not as windy. It was windy over there and I was like, I hope it's not as windy on stage. It's not, in case any other poets were wondering. I'm in a really silly mood. I'm just having a good day. lately, I haven't been doing a lot of readings. I've kind of had my head down in the act of, you know, doing the work. In April, I decided I got really into sonnets. So a lot of my work tonight is sonnets, so a little on the shorter side. This is entitled, Sometimes I miss being surrounded by corn and soybean fields. When you drive past them, you can aim your eye down each row easy. You can think about all the hands that plant, the hands that gather, that tame the combine. The green is so green that it could only belong to nature. I am still jealous. The corn stalks, brittle by November, turn caramel confetti when we grab them. The air is a musky harvest, corn dust mixed with dirt and diesel, the smell of change. Each ear's silk is pulled down, stubborn zipper, strings still clinging between rows of kernel pale sun soldiers, lemonades, baby teeth. This is another sonnet, and again, I didn't title it. It was written on April 4th, so let's just call it April 4th. Are you guys out there? Yeah. Okay. Things in my secret big wheel compartment. Twigs and sticks, crumpled vein of maple leaf, a palm's heft of peculiar red berries, vibrant, bruised, rumored to be poisonous. Secrets, at least the ones that fit. Gifted glint of 25 cents unspent, afraid to waste my riches. Miracle of bird feather boasts fractured barbs and daggered quill, the one every grandma warns not to touch. I touch, I take. I slip it under seat with my interesting rocks and found receipts, a stone I swear must be aerolith, and Barbie shoe plucked from Curb's dish, found wishbone, fragment I stop peddling to plead with. Thanks. I'm just going to keep on trucking, so you don't have to apologize. You save all that energy up. All right. This one has a title. It's also, well, no, it's not a sonnet. It's called To Know a Backseat. To know a backseat while your stepfather drives around with both direction and none, enraged, looking for his wife, your mother. He is looking for your first home, dancing in a downtown club. She walks and laughs, brown sugar legs on edge of her seat, hops down with a, sure, I'll dance. And we are looking for her at the main entrance and back door, the alley with its mysteries, its stench of piss and garbage, street lights high five the oil slicks. My first home is oblivious to our hunt, has her own in process. Crosshair, stiletto. If we succeed and pick her up, her eyes are heavy, her teeth the only light in the Honda. We will pull over 5 times so she can vomit. It will be a soft rock and silent treatment soundtrack. The booze in reverse is a stench that clings to her, stays in the car, and twist turns my stomach beneath the zipper of my pajamas, of course ones with the feet. I am so small. This one is entitled, my God, get it together. The first line has a saying that I always really liked. Everybody's probably heard it, let go or be dragged. I mean, I think it's very, it makes sense. You didn't hear that? Yeah. Let go or be dragged. Please tell my knees that, with their mess of gravel dents and scarlet poppies, elbows polished down to the bone. Let go or be left. Learn lesson, not yet. Hindsight loves a filter almost as much as I love taping blame to the mirror. No source of misery quite like my own. Time doesn't care about your speed limits. I promise the plane will leave without you. I guarantee the weeds will find a way to continue growth. So stay where you are, self. See what happens when you hang on to what is gone. To your daughter's hair, to the vacant space, to missing hands, to your malnutritioned love. You guys aren't listening. Don't clap. It's time is of the essence. Okay, Mom. This is called, I'm sorry, I wasn't trying to be bossy about it. See, now I'm worried. All right. I have a 2.5-year-old now, and it's been crazy, and this poem is about that craziness, I guess, the early days. This is called The Newborn Forest. Baby slips into slumber with a minor flare of limb. Laps in latch, nipple side free. Single globule of milk rivers from lips corner to jaw's velvet turn. Dream in my lap oblivious to crumbling skyline that holds her, I'm sorry, pours out of me. A ballad of terror and defeat. My warped wood voice bent by the hours I do not sleep. Will she ever know this moment of me? How I hold my breath, how I hate my lungs, army of molars crushing the core. I am so chewed up by love. One day my daughter might ask about this nebulous stretch of survival. What do I give her? Lullaby of my life, you were born and you were mine. You smelled like a known sweetness. I reeked of copper. I bled and I bled. When you first started nursing, I had to use all of my hands, even the shores of them. In the hospital, our bathroom ceiling fell in. Your father had wet socks. It wheeled us to a new room, one with so much more light, from Kansas to Oz. Your body slung over mine, minutes mattering by each need met. Swell of reverence, a devotion that pummeled like grief. Even a room apart proved too far. My arms no longer arms unless they held you. I cried so much. Crying is a tiny word for what I've done. This is how they invent oceans, I bet. All the new mothers own these oceans, but no one lets us name them. I learned every hour of the night, lonely as a forest winter, rocked and nursed past Cinderella's curfew, through last call, as the birds of 4 a.m. cued overdue cradle song. My shrine of morning light, you miracle that broke me, hushed and marveling at the precision of your philtrum, love letter written in its curve. I whisper old myth to you. The stars above we cannot see. Odes to the deeds of heroes and beasts. Athena, born warrior from the head of her father, full grown and dressed in armor. Jaw of Midas shattered on gilded berry, his daughter forever the color of autumn. The stork that bit you has been dealt with. Gutted, throat slit, beak kept to bless with ink, mouth of pin sharp and dangerous, the beginning of your story. I write with it until stem of the weapon cracks in fist, until bone of it is dusted down to filament. Then I will thread it through the overhead to light the whole damn home with. How am I on time?
Good.
Is 2 more okay? Okay. Sorry.
Dickie?
Yes.
He's going to bring the front gate down. It's kind of loud.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I like the traffic sound though too. Yeah, I'm obsessed with my kid, so I've been writing a lot about her, but you know. They're great poems. Because she's a great kid. This one is called Tea and Oranges. My favorite parts of you were balanced on fists and dead riders, middle fingers jutting up rusted, outlasting most landmarks as the city busted seams and spilled its paint through all the neighboring fields. You remain the unruined, or rather, the never revitalized, tender to the touch. Our first night we spent on the stoop, marveling moon at the street inn rising and rising. A passing car hurled raw eggs and the shells snapped by our shoes. 1-2, 1-2, your own empty palm backlit in headlights. I sank the image into brain's amber, a romantic's urge to preserve it all. To the boy kicked off the bus for punching someone square in the face. For your whiskey wrist, shaking key into lock, for a key bent into comma, the books kept for wooing, Dylan Thomas in July, Burroughs when you trusted me, for the poems in lowercase and the bathtub filled with the sad roar of laundry, for all the songs that made you cry, the lost hour somewhere between the bar and hell, for your shoe print on my thigh, for every couch you called home, you on one knee, the snow in December, empty bottle raised to Turrentine, for my stereo pond and our rooftop grief, for the cardigan covering our heads, pressed together till they hurt, for all that rain still soaking us to the bone. And I have one more. Thank you for being a good audience. I'm very out of practice with reading out, so if I seem awkward, it's true, I'm awkward. What if I was somebody who did that every time I read and I was just wanting accolades? I wanted people to be like, oh, your grades! What are you talking about? Maybe it would be... Anyway... this is my last one. Thank you for being an attentive audience. I am so excited about the other poets reading. They're really, really good people and good friends and great poets, and I'm very excited. The end. This is a sonnet about my daughter, and it has no title. Story of my life. I'm so sorry. I'm just in a really happy mood. When my daughter picks up speed on her feet, she stretches one arm forward while yelling, I'm running, I'm running! As if perhaps we missed it. Or maybe the announcement is for her own benefit, declaring this new pace of freedom. How she must feel unbound trajectory, wind giggling through her curls. The joy is otherworldly. I resist urge to follow too close. Of course she could fall. If I step in each time she stumbles, what does it give her? I can't unbuckle the sidewalk. My girl will learn the grit and sing of a scraped knee. She picks up speed. I hang back. I watch her get free. Thank you.
Yes, yes. Wow. Jason Baldinger is a poet and photographer. He's co-editor of Trailer Park Quarterly. And as we know around here, he co-curates the Odd Month reading series with Don Wentworth, Scott Silsby. He has penned 15 books. Oh, my goodness. And he has a new book of photography that has come out called Lazarus. And you really should have a copy of that, including and also copies of some of his poems, for heaven's sakes. You can hear him read, not just here, but also on Bandcamp and on other things called Goto Beds and some other things I don't know how to pronounce. But Bandcamp for sure I can pronounce. Please welcome John, okay, Jason Baldinger, yay.
Thanks, Joan. It's nice to be here for Hemingway's the 50th anniversary season. Congratulations to you. I love this spot. Now I have to take my glasses off. I can't see a fucking thing anymore. It's just how it is. All right. I got a book called A History of Backroads Misplaced, Selected Poems 2010 to 2020. That's where we're going to start. This is a bit of a journey all the way through. This is a poem called A Palomino and a Bull Snake. There were four water towers on the Salinas skyline, more than 10 rooms with private bath in the place where I stayed. I lived the last couple days on gin and tequila, There's been no need to hit the brakes over the last 80 miles. It feels like I'm barnstorming a prairie fire. The longest train I ever saw was in Amarillo. That was before today, although it may have been Sheridan. Amarillo is 400 miles south. Sheridan is a Palomino and a bull snake away. In the distance, there's a storm stuck over Topeka. I've seen so much big sky and empty plains, it makes me want to swing north for the Badlands. I could make Rapid City by morning. Yesterday, I learned that Mexican buffet is the two most perfect words in the English language. And as I left, I noticed the only graffiti on the men's room wall, "My asshole is burning." Except the S's were faint. They had been corralled to some Baptist ranch in the sky where profanity is still the devil's tongue. Yesterday, I learned how to turn breadcrumbs into bluebirds. If I head north and gun it to Nebraska, I'm going to try my luck turning motels into buffalo. Thank you. American Aorta is my newest book of poetry. And this is a poem for the late Kansas poet Diane Watteau. Time went the way of the buffalo. I know Wichita from a gas station overlooking the interstate. A jaw-dropping sunrise over the Flint Hills, I pulled my hoodie up against October. With 800 miles ahead, one last gasp of Wichita before wagons west. It's sad we never met. We should have had breakfast, but time went the way of the buffalo. I would have loved to hear in person your story of marching 5 miles in Kalamazoo. You and your friend against the Vietnam War. You and your friend all dressed up in high heels. If you buy American Aorta, I do still have a couple copies of this Blackout Elvis Death Psalms. It's 8 erasure poems that I used the Nashville, Tennessee, an article from the day after Elvis's death to fashion. So, does that make sense? Hopefully it does. 8 haikus fashioned from an Who's article about Elvis. There we go. Rhythm and blues shook the hammer. It's your turn. Thank you. I have a new book coming out with Rebecca Schmeda. It's my photography, her words. I was 2022, I was at SCI Crescent, which was then doing self-guided tours, took a bunch of photos looking specifically for something for her then new book, Sentenced, which came out on New York Quarterly. We did find that book cover, but a couple weeks later, I started getting poems. Those poems became a book called Hope is a Prison, which is a meditation between women and cycles of abuse, I guess is probably the easiest way to place it. So this poem is called Last Rites. It was inspired by a photo that I took of a Bible sitting on a rostrum in an abandoned prison chapel. The last time I heard my father's voice was when my grandmother was transitioning in hospice. We were gathered around her bed saying our goodbyes when her son called collect from prison to encourage her to ask for the Lord's forgiveness. While death rattled in her throat, I looked out the window, a stray cat battered around a bluebird. My grandmother dismissed religion long before I was born, but kept a crucifix in her nightstand drawer. She had a stray cat husband who held my father like a feather between his teeth. She looked out the same window, then at me as my father yammered on about redemption. Or maybe she didn't look out the window. Maybe I just wanted her to. The last time she spoke directly to me was the day before her son was sentenced. Just tell the truth, that he didn't really hurt you, she begged. Just tell the truth. All right. Hemingway's is 50 years old.
Oh. Where did that shit go?
What was that shit?
That's important shit. I might need to read that shit. Oh, I just read that shit. Well, it's not that important then. All right. Yeah. Hemingway's is 50 years old. January, I was watching, was it the fighter that Jimmy was in as a training coach or a boxing trainer?
Anyway, I saw Jimmy. It sparked some things. Seems appropriate to read tonight. This is called In Dog Years. Can I do this? Okay. I saw Jimmy Sveta caught a shard of that voice. He was a ringside coach in a strip club parking lot mixed martial arts fight in a movie that's over a decade old, his face still full and flush before the cancer whittled him. And I thought about a Silsby poem where he talks about a saved voicemail. Jimmy rasps that he was not blowing smoke up anyone's ass. And I thought how lucky I was over the years to be in a bar full of poets, listening to Jimmy read the title, maybe the first line of a poem, before launching off into another meandering story told in dog years. Nick Nolte was in this movie too, a gruff voice, grizzled old trainer too, maybe a tribute to his good friend. I signed a book for Nolte at the end of one of those readings. Not sure what to write, I could and probably should have said something simple, like thank you. But being a little worse for drink, I may have said something like, my mother has a crush on you. All right. So, as Joan mentioned, I do the odd month reading series with Scott Silsby and Don Wentworth, two handsome gentlemen over there. We are having a reading Saturday night at Bantha Tea Bar. Akron, Ohio poets, Steve Brightman and Teresa Gottlieb Brightman, as well as Rick St. John, will all be reading. It's free, but there will be a tip jar for the artists. There is also, not to get too many things in your head, an even month, a rare even month on August 1st. Three Indiana poets, Tony Brewer, Nicole Brooke Plummer, and Johnny Baker are coming, and they will be joined by Miss Macross. So that's Thursday, August 1st. Both events will start at 7 p.m. and start promptly on time. I know that's an oxymoron. I need another drink of beer. All right, this is called Hard Time Eyes. Three Confederate skeletons molder through a dogwood night. Second Avenue lights shine from downtown Oasis, past where motels go to pasture and green corn begins its rise. Three Confederate skeletons, gray hair growing down the back of Kiss tees, baggy jeans painted with Ohio River mud, they double time it back to camp, past the Cadillac Motel and Halfway House. Mutton warms on the fire, graybacks burning a hole in their pockets, old Jeff Davis's eyes wide after a taste. Sure thing, the South will rise again. Three Confederate skeletons pass. The woman at the liquor store stashes moonshine pints as Victor, announced by doorbell, asks for a bottle of wine. She looks at him with hard time eyes. Honey, I don't know a goddamn thing about no wine. Thank you. All right. This is called A People's History of Williamson, West Virginia. Do I have all of it? Yes, I do. Okay. Is it sticking together? There we go. Now we're good. Don't blow away. You said there wasn't a breeze, Nikki. All right, People's History of Williamson, West Virginia. We could have gone to the prom with the Coal House girls. Crushed red velvet dresses, Keller drawn richer in humidity. They wait for dreams and corsages to die just like Romeo and Juliet. Instead, we hold up in a burned out department store, rechristened junk shop, sifting boxes of 10-cent black and white photos, watching A People's History of Williamson, West Virginia as a remaindered flip book. Camera flash illuminates, moment heads crane above the surface. A new used car sitting in pea gravel under a pawpaw. The sun shining off the canal as she sat neatly on a picnic bench. Smoking uncles, messy rubber-legged toddlers. Beehived ants, got Halloween witches, coal black-faced miners carrying lunches and gunny sacks. Not one graduation in sight. No one ever actually smiling. Only distance read in eyes focused on the ledge of another mountain range. These boxes, never rescued, sepia, acid-stained, or rusted pipe-washed, eight lanes of train tracks that led out of town, now left to oxidize, burnt Siena memories,
Keller faded ghosts haunt paper alone. Three more for you. Thank you for being an attentive audience. And it's going to be more dynamite after me. John Dorsey, Scott Silsby, Leslie Ann McElroy. It'll be awesome. All right, this is called a Howard Johnson prayer. Nothing has a right being this beautiful. In the mighty exhale of crossing the heartland again, the chill that saturates post-Labor Day, the sun already a victim, but there are no stars in this fenced pool parking lot watering hole with logos looming, billboards crowing, and traffic blowing past headlights through honeycomb in the interstate close enough to hear it whinny at the horizon. Another outlaw moment, flat earth and floodplain, 250 miles and 25 milligrams waiting on corn stalks to colonize these temples. Cold blue water steals as it reinforces this essence. I float on dreams that stretch middle Mississippi to Machu Picchu. I float a black and white dream. Memories of a dark sky, meditation. All right, this next is a short haiku, another oxymoron, for Bart Sularchek, who just passed away. Rip Bart. It's a long journey, brother. Wind blown between beers. Crows guide the way. Thank you, thank you. Last poem, Ode to Miles Davis's He Loved Him Madly, just from his 1974 record, Get Up With It. Spend 35 minutes with yourself. Enjoy it. Ode to Miles Davis's He Loved Him Madly. These mornings pass in poses, 30 seconds at a time, pacing breath on a snare hit, try and unwind 47 years of what capitalism wrought. Organ rising winds into construction crews milling pavement, house shakes, its open windows accept what little chatter comes from the sparrow wall, accepts the lost voice of another working man, just another day in paradise. The cat steals heating pad, tries to unwind 90 years. Now listen as guitar razors out a riff only to pull back on the wah before meeting a trumpet's mute. Reverb-drenched flute settles and I count off seconds, this drifting composition, this expansion of language, building off ideas colliding with restraint in the way Duke Ellington taught us. Duke knew he'd never see Christmas in 1974, so he sent holiday cards right before Memorial Day to jazz luminaries, to friends, a last chance to say goodbye, a last chance to give thanks. Miles cried when he got his card. It closed the way Duke ended all of his shows, with a kiss blown from stage and the words, love you madly. Thank you. Take it away, Joan.
Ah, that's better. Okay. John Dorsey is the author of several collections of poetry, but I actually count about 10. Maybe I'm missing something. I think I got maybe more than that. And they have really interesting titles. So I'm going to read a couple of these titles. Teaching the Dead to Sing, The Outlaw's Prayer, Sodomy is a City in New Jersey, Appalachian Frankenstein, Being the Fire, Which Way to the River, Afterlife Karaoke. Oh, and there's more. He's been nominated for the Pushcart, Best of the Net, and he's the winner of the 2019 Terry Award given by Poetry Rendezvous. Please welcome John Dorsey.
Thank you, Joan. You know, I was on NPR many years ago, and I had the host actually ask me if sodomy was indeed a city in New Jersey. All right. You know, I'm grateful to see everybody. I have to admit, I was most excited to see Nikki because I hoped she was going to bring the baby. So next time. Yeah. All right, this is a poem about one of the worst weddings I've ever been to in my life. Where it was the only wedding I've ever been to where the wedding party went to the bar before the wedding. And we went to a place called Ermy's Lounge in South Toledo. If you have the chance, never go there. All right. This is called A Summer Wedding at Ermy's Lounge. Before we ever got to the church, the entire wedding party pulled the limos up in front of the bar. Because somebody's great aunt's third cousin had left an open tab, and the sun seemed to pour in from outside and reflect off 1,000 different NASCAR posters that lined the walls. Even as it rained outside, I went into the bathroom and did lines off the toilet seat just to prove I was still cliche enough to be there. But being the wisest man in a hillbilly soap opera is hardly a moral victory. Pissed drunk before noon and not quite high enough to love ourselves, we should have stayed there. Where a stripper with gap teeth played pool and sang, "Let's get drunk and screw," as her lungs filled with hope in the shape of a coffin. And it was the most honest thing I'd ever heard. And God was in full view. And we exchanged vows with a shot glass set on fire. As holy as any church and as beautiful as any summer flower in search of light. As anyone who is close to me knows, I had cancer surgery about a year and a half ago. Now it's closer to that. And one of the things that is upsetting to me, I'm 47, but so many of the people that I see are like 15. And they're in worse shape than I am, so... I had a conversation with a girl at the cancer clinic about Nicolas Cage, who I happen to believe is the greatest actor of our time. And if you haven't seen Long Legs, you should go to it. But so I wrote this poem about this girl that I met. It's called Poem for the Nick Cage Superfan at the Ellis Fischel Cancer Center. We weren't meant to sit in waiting rooms and paper masks. But once you make it through the zombie apocalypse, rooms like this are all that's left. A pale young girl, not even old enough to drive, has medical bracelets on up to her elbows, and a single tattoo of a rose half visible on her upper shoulder. She prays for a fiery car crash or some light hand-to-hand combat while jumping out of a plane that's running out of gas that she calls her body. Anything exciting enough to wake her from the stupor of her medication? As she talks to me about Nick Cage for at least 10 minutes, maybe this conversation has been going on for centuries. We all pray to our own gods, vampires, and holy men. Sometimes you have to let out a scream in the middle of the night because it just feels right. Shaking the cancer from your skin. Sometimes you have to imagine, what would Nick Cage do in this situation? And I think my God will punch your God right in the face, because sometimes that feels right too. Many years ago, I worked in a Walden's bookstore, and if you were new, they gave you this shitty job, and the shitty job was running the calendar kiosk in the middle of the mall and having middle-aged dudes come by and just check out the girls in swimsuits and then buy calendars with cats on them. But I had an MRI in December where I was all freaked out, so I wrote this poem. This is called On the Prospect of Dying in December. Not the end of the year, but maybe the end of your life. And you don't know if you should buy another calendar. You didn't buy the one you have now. You think about how every morning felt like you were about to be shot out of a cannon, with no furniture and plenty of ramen. How life like that makes great poems, but offers little peace. Though in the end, that goes away anyway. So you run out into the street and make a note to remind yourself to tell people you love them before you realize you're dreaming and wonder if any of it was ever real. You would never have given leaves any thought before this. You would have let ghosts go right on dreaming about sparrows on the tattooed arms of young girls who write poems about the moon. Only now you write them too. They're all about the past. And whatever year it is, you're sitting there alone. My cousin is here, and she can attest to this. Our aunt would take us to concerts at times, and some of them like were way, way out of the age range that we were, and we saw Kiss, and Kiss has this annoying habit of like doing a farewell tour, and then 3 years later, they're back again, and they never seem to fucking go away. And so I wrote this book. It's called Farewell Tour. It was published in England. But this is the title poem from that. At 15, we all want to fly into the sun when it still seems like there's plenty of time to find our way back on that next bit of highway before the road less traveled is closed for repairs, before crumbling away altogether. Where Kerouac and Richard Hugo throw their wild fist in the air, blanketing the Montana sky with youth, never imagining they'll be dead, never dreaming that this is where all of the wishing wells will run out of water. At 46, I think about how someone had to find Ted Berrigan's bloated body, about how someone had to chip Bruce Embry's heartbroken heart free from an icy Idaho stream. As a pair of deers drank in every word, one day soon, I'll end up in some dry Missouri patch of grass. Right now, though, I'm thinking about how at 15 I raised my fist at a Kiss concert in a now demolished arena in Pittsburgh. I think about how, like God, Gene Simmons could make the lights go dim just by waving his hands, and how Kiss could keep coming back every few years, fatter and fatter, with their makeup running down their faces under the broiling stage lights without ever once reaching the sun, and how while Kerouac remains buried in the ground, sometimes farewell doesn't have to mean forever. I'm going to read about three more poems here. Okay. If I can find this, which I should be able to. Here we go. I live in a very small town, and every year, it's 99.9% white people, but every summer they have a town fair, and one year I was throwing out hard candy at small children as I want to do. And so there was a pregnant girl on her lawn wearing a Tupac Shakur t-shirt. And my only thought was, where the fuck did she get that shirt? And so I wrote this poem. It's called East Coast, West Coast in Southern Missouri. A high school girl with thick black glasses and a baby bump barely concealed by a secondhand Tupac t-shirt stands on the front of her lawn. As a volunteer fireman who didn't make it past the ninth grade throws candy in her direction with a pitching arm that will never take him any further than the next county over. A love story held together with tape, like the glasses peeling in the summer sun. Candy corn at her feet like stray bullets in a gang war in a music video that will last the rest of her life. A baby under each arm, pacing east and west, a drive-by that goes in circles leading nowhere, always in rivalry with possibility. Maybe the old owner of the shirt fed the hungry, danced in an empty swimming pool, and swore there was music that nobody else could hear. Or maybe she actually saw who killed Tupac and Biggie both and never said a word. Because there was peace in just letting things go, like the boy who placed the shirt over her shoulders as she shivered, taking what she hadn't offered to begin with. Because when you wash out the bloodstains, all you're left with is your own heartbreak, standing on your own front lawn, wearing someone else's dream, shrunken down so many times with wrinkles that you can never quite smooth out. Until you're almost invisible, with a snow cone melting down your arm in the sun, bleeding red, white, and blue, as a single sock fresh out of the dryer sticks to your belly, and that's the best part of your day. I'm gonna do something that I don't think enough people do in poetry when there are readings. I'm gonna read you a poem by my friend Victor Clevenger, who's here with us today. It's become my practice, like over the last 20 years, to usually pick a poem by one other person and make sure they get represented. Usually it's a friend of mine who's passed away, who isn't here to speak for themselves, but gratefully Victor's here, so. All right, this is a poem called Virginity Lost, and it's from a chapbook that he had out called The Aching Season, so. Yes, there is a possibility that our innocence will be lost in the inferno, darling. Pressed tightly against you, we breathe only when we breathe. We breathe only when we push back, separate, and gasp. We breathe only when we push back, separate, and gasp. Yes, there is the possibility that our innocence will be lost in the inferno, darling. Yes, there is. Yes, there is. And I am not scared at all. Like they say we should be. Young, burning love, forever carrying our bag of ash and bones. And and I know that Victor could read that better than me. It's always, you try to catch someone else's rhythm, and it's not always the easiest thing in the world. I wasn't sure what to finish. Okay, I'll finish with this. I lived in a trailer park for a good bulk of my life, and I did this little book of mostly trailer park poems. It's called The Double Wide Book of the Dead. But this is just the title poem from that. The Double Wide Book of the Dead. Our house wasn't nearly that big, with its cheap plaster walls, where I covered my bedroom with posters of long-forgotten 80s hair bands and built a temple to suburban poverty with awful ghost stories scribbled into yellow legal pads, with awful poems about pale girls scribbled into yellow legal pads. It was all doll ink and Saturday morning cartoons and reduced lunch tickets with peanut butter sandwiches and tomato soup every day and dreams hidden away in pencil boxes and coins tossed into shopping mall fountains and girls with hips as wide as jelly bracelets. You could only corral so many spirits into such a tight space until the dead started to look like you, like your mom or your dad when they were your age, when they looked for answers in sad songs too, in broken houses where the dead had more room to roam and stretch their legs and dance. You know, I just like to thank my family for being here. We usually have family reunions. We call them funerals. So it's nice that everybody here is above ground. And I'm not a whore like my friend Jason Baldinger, but I do have a book or two on me. But he is a handsome man. Look at him. All right. Thank you, Joan.
What an evening this is. And two more poets to come. All right. Well, I've known Leslie Ann McElroy for a long time, like 20 years?
20.
20 plus, at least. And Leslie Ann McElroy won the 1997 Slipstream Poetry Chapbook. Well, but I'm going to just say a couple of things here. She's had a lot of work published, and she has a new book, which is called, which is a memoir, The Red Door, an historical memoir of the Squirrel Hill Cafe, published in 2020 by Main Street Rag. And she lives here in Pittsburgh, and it is a great pleasure to have her reading at the Hemingway series, which she has done over many years. It's so great to have her back. Please welcome Leslie McElroy and McElroy.
Hey, you know what? I'm so old school. Jimmy taught my daughter about my daughter, who was my daughter, who's now my son. Jimmy Savetic got my son into poetry. I'm eternally grateful. I've always been a poet. I've always been a poet in my son's eyes, but Jimmy got my son into poetry, and he read here a couple months ago, and you know what? This series is the best thing that Pittsburgh has. It's been going on so long, and I'm so grateful to you and Chris and Dawn for keeping it going. I can't even tell you. I'm so honored to be. There's no other place I'd rather read in Pittsburgh than this series. It's the best. It gives Pittsburgh the best of Pittsburgh. The poets are amazing, and I am so excited to follow what I just heard. That was, yeah, like, how am I gonna top that? Thank you. But I am going to start with that, you know, and it's not poetry, it's flash fiction, because I've turned my poetry into flash fiction. But this is a piece that means the entire world to me, because I wrote it probably 10 years ago, and it took a really long time. I swear, Ellen McGrath Smith looked at it, she's like, I don't know, years ago. And finally, it got published by the Texas Review last year. It's not long, but I feel like it's very poetic. And it's called The Man on the Horse. I don't like men on horses. And the first part is called fiction. First is the house. It is large and wooden, and there is smoke, which suggests that someone lives there. But the house is empty, empty and clean, which suggests someone lives there, but it is empty, except for the man. This is where the truth gets cloudy, the memory. Who knows if the narrator, that's me, can be trusted, her motives. Let's give her the wooden house and the man. Smoke and the smell of floor polish. The man is faceless and strong. He is not vindictive or mean. He is not nice. Part two, Frankenstein and the swing. The man appears in strange places, like at the rope swing in the girl's backyard. He watches the girl, who counts as she swings back and forth, toes dragging in a crushed clay gravel, drawing lines in red. When the girl looks up, she sees his face. It's kind of a Frankensteinian mold. Not green, but cast of unowned parts. She is frightened, but more than frightened, she is sorry for him. This may be her biggest mistake. She continues swinging, counting until he leaves. He walks slowly, like a sewn-up man would. The part about him working in a mill is made up. In her mind, he works in the dark with fire. He is mighty and precise. He is skilled. She doesn't know why she gives him this. He is not apologetic. That would be worse. Mostly he shows up in the basement, the woods, the house, and sometimes on the bus. Most recently, he is a man on the horse wearing a cowboy hat, which she detests. When she sees him, it is not fear, but pain. When she closes her eyes to the smokestacks, the mill, the fire, she appreciates that he cleans what he can from his fingernails. She appreciates that he doesn't ask her not to tell. He knows she doesn't want to share this. What would she say? Frankenstein on the swing? It is hard growing apart from the man. She has known him forever. This means he has done his job well. He is proud, has a work ethic. She carries him with her. Rough fingers, swollen joints, closed palm into her grown-up life, which, like the swing, has a rhythm, back and forth. She still drags her feet. Part three, the naming. Characters need names, but the man remains nameless. The girl is called Anne without an E. Anne never calls out to the man or mentions him in a way that requires address. Sometimes she kisses boys and refuses to say their names. She has forgotten more than she remembers. Drinking has something to do with it. The man drinks, she drinks with him. It makes them feel better. Sometimes it goes bad. She doesn't blame the man for making her cry, for making her think about suicide. That gives him too much power. She adds an E to the end of her name. For a long time, the man leaves. Anne feels a hole in her she can't explain. Who will love her? Her with the hole. She walks down Darlington Avenue,
feels the wind blow through the hole. A pipeline drilled straight through her, missing the heart. The cold makes a sound not unlike a fox caught in a trap, mournful and scared, the sound of the amputee, the healing over what's gone. The man renames nameless, but now has a sound. Part 4, bullet points. Jobs remain her focus. She has a work ethic rewarded by more work. Sometimes she feels an anger rise inside her, disproportionate. I think that's my phone. It is. Are you turning it off? Yeah, thank you. Her boss tells her the story is too long. Can she cut? Stick to smaller, more familiar words. The reader might be alienated by chic. She replaces it with fancy and transforms the prose to bite-sized bullet points, abandons transition. She pours a glass of cheap vodka and lets the rage settle. The ice melt. It doesn't matter. There are gaps in this story. It doesn't flow. Part 5. Inequity. But then there is love, which too is disproportionate. She understands inequity, the way she loves men way more than they do her, men who give her only part of what she wants. They're important parts, poetry, song, a deviance that allows her to relinquish control, if only in bed. They don't try to fix or fill her. They often leave once she brings up the hole, the sound, the fox. Nobody wants to marry a girl trapped like that. Part 6, the trap. Anne has learned to both set and trip the trap. She will not enter, no matter how starved. When the fox nears, she throws it bits of chicken from behind the trip plate, ushers it from ambush. Day and night, she stays like this, hiding her scent when the man approaches. He cannot smell her because she is a hole, a sound now, the wind. She is camouflaged with sorrow. The man set the trap to catch her, to catch the fox, to finish the game. But he tires of it, as men do. And when the weather turns cold, his visits become more infrequent. He feels a pulling apart, a detachment, a hole. Anne buys warm gloves, carries sardines, follows the fox far away. When the man returns in spring, he finds the trap vacant. Anne has left no tracks, not the house, not the swing, not the bus, not the basement, only a meadow across the state line. Here in the meadow, the fox makes a den. Here, the fox raises its kits. Here, Anne listens to the sound of herself dusted in pollen. Here, she takes the man apart and buries his pieces, places his hat on a small grave, a marker. Here, she lets the horse free. That's a long piece. But I love it, and I swear to God, I would say to you that's the story of my life, and that it finally got published last year makes me happier. I don't have to do anything else ever again that makes me stupid happy. But here, because Silas, my son, read here a few weeks ago, which is super cool. And I love that he is a poet. I didn't train him that way. Of course I didn't. But he is, and he's a brilliant poet. But this is a poem for him, and it's called Everything Looks Like Bones to Me. The clouds, the moon, the occasional sliver of light, the shadows, the stone. I say femur, you say tibia. You know more than I, so I nod and keep looking. You have a fascination for skeletons, I for the things that hold us together. That is a mandible intact, you say. Put it in its own bag. Keep it safe. I follow your instructions, my little bone wizard, watching as you whisper a small prayer, as you pull matted fur from the spine. Later, I rescue a dead skunk from the road and give it to your bone world. You say, cleansing the bones honors the animal, its soul. I believe you and assist. I buy buckets for their bodies and chemicals. Together we work, mother and son. Bones are what we share. They will outlast us both. Carry the weight of our joy and sorrow. Carry the remains and the spirit, the piecing together. This simple act of love. That is for Silas. I love him so much. We have all kinds of little bone bodies in our basement. It's pretty cool. He's piecing them together. We're going to have a full opossum bone skeleton soon. This is for Riz because it's called 60 and Hot. And neither one of us are 60, but we're around there somewhere. So it's all working. The setting is soup, thick and simmering. Pittsburgh with its scorched steel glaze, the wave of Hephaestus' smokestack fury. Lover like longing, this steamy bath the conditioned air can't even penetrate as we idle in the shade of a borrowed shadow. We wear nothing that can't be removed. Whoops, I lost myself. Say nothing that can't be chilled with the cold body of regret, the frozen eyes of a deer. In this summer of sweltering, we give everything to fire, blazing together night after night, feeding yearning's furnace. When I ask if you are cool enough, you say, am I? In your dad joke voice, and even our laughter is hot on the tongue. Like this, day after day, we thrive despite, because, as if liquid, flowing, flammable, we are here to ignite and burn. Okay, that was just a sex poem, sorry about that. I don't know where I am time-wise. I'm at one more? Okay. This is called The Elephant Was Never Invisible. The weight of her hoof on the settee, the damp on the rug where she lay, the house, a collection of jungle gossip. No need to address or undress her. She never wore or said a thing. Just looked around for another pachyderm to blame. So many now. The doors need widening, the trunks tangled, and oh, the tusks. But still, no one apologizes or stops referencing her in the third person. The stench is all they mention. Patchouli, mildew, a hint of sorrow. So one day, she goes missing, the way grudges do, weary of shame. And still, not a word, just hearsay, rumors, lies. No note, no forwarding address. Her memory all but faded, thankful for the blessings of a thick skin. Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Joan.
Hey, yay. And our final reader tonight is Scott Silsby, who, as we know, was born in Detroit, and he is the author of 4 books, and they have wonderful titles. Meet Me Where We Survive, Muskrat Family Dinner, yum yum, The River Underneath the City, Unattended Fire. He's assistant editor at Logos Press, and as some of you know, he is also he also co-curates the Odd Month poetry series with Jason and Don, and he's had a poem in LA Cultural Weekly. I've got to find it. Wow. Please welcome Scott Silsby.
Thanks, Joan. Hi, everybody. Everybody doing good? Good. I'm mostly going to read. Oh, I want to do some thank yous. Thank you, Joan. Thank you, Chris, in absentia. Thank you, Hop Farm. Thank you, Don, for everything that you do. And thank you to my fellow readers. I'm going to read mostly new stuff tonight, but start with a couple from my last book. This one goes out to that weirdo, Jason Irwin. Where's my bucket? 3 men sit in the booth of a bar drinking draft beers from pint glasses. They make slow, deliberate movements. They talk about books, music, politics. One of them says, "Let's prank somebody." The others laugh, but he's serious about it. A man named Elvis walks into the bar. The merry prankster yells, "Elvis!" loud enough for the man named Elvis to hear his name shouted over the bar noise. He sees the prankster and comes over to the booth where the 3 men sit. Elvis has half of a sandwich in a bag. He's wearing a University of Pittsburgh jacket, and he tells the 3 men about his job, about driving cross-country, about what it feels like to find yourself in an earthquake, grabbing for a tree to stabilize yourself, but realizing that the tree is shaking and not stable either. When Elvis leaves the table, the prankster pranks a plumber, not knowing that he is a plumber, yelling, "Where's my bucket?" into the phone. He pranks Jimmy, a retired cop turned poet turned boxing instructor, and says, "I had too many onion rings. I just puked all over the bar. Pick me up." It's just this way with poets sometimes. Sometimes the world that they live in needs them to give it a little extra color. Thanks. This one goes out to Chandra Alderman. Archaeological bells. They've buried the dreams underground, I think. We don't seem to have them anymore, the dreams. So I think it must be that someone disposed of them, did away with them, maybe put them underground. When we dig for the world that others left behind, we find jewelry or tools. We sometimes find bells. The bells no longer ring or make any kind of noise. Perhaps they've been buried underground too long, like the dreams or visions, the other lives we live. An abridgment of the light of the world. I was looking up into the branches of the royal star magnolia, though I don't know what I was looking for. And I thought of Mark up in Erie, home from work, writing his little death poems, in his own universe, But aren't we all really? I will admit that at times everything seems to me all full up with death and dying or loss and grieving, failure and suffering, everything broken. But then she says she has never been treated so well by another person as you. She says that every day you remind me who I am. And that is light to go on, a full breath of clean air, something to step to. All right, this next one I snagged the title from Sun Ra, and then the last line I kind of used most of a line by Stephen Triplett, who read here at Hemingway's last year. But I kind of tweaked it and made it my own. Tapestry from an Asteroid. That was the summer of the unrelenting wildflower smoke. It felt like the end of something, but not completely dire. Every night those birds started up with their chattering in one direction as the sun was setting in the other direction. The sea was never the same twice. It was somewhere beyond. I had a dream of sleeping and the wrong end of a straight flush. It really wasn't all that dark out, and I wasn't quite sure why. I am another one, I said to no one. I am something else. I know a fugue when I hear one, and I know my question. I don't know her anymore, but I think we are both alive. Thanks. Thai basil. Bobby got me a little Thai basil plant. I put it in my kitchen by the window. He told me that I needed to pluck the little purple flowers off, saying that if I didn't, it would go to seed. But I thought the flowers were pretty. They made me think of you. I was already thinking of you. Thanks. This next one is a found poem. Letter tucked in a copy of the September 1965 issue of Poetry Magazine. Dear John, I was sorry that we got into different cars the night we left Leslie's and that I didn't have a chance to say goodbye to you. I've been wanting to give you a copy of my last poem. Because in the winter of 1962, when you were here, you decided Astrid and I should, after dinner one wildly snowstorming night, walk with you around the lakes. I said I couldn't go because I was stuck in a poem about drinking. You insisted I should go. It was wonderful, and I was glad I did. And you wondered what I might have to say about drinking. I went in for the last swim of the season the day after the meeting, watched over only by Ralphie and Littlefellow. Thereafter, if they hadn't closed the pool, I think I'd not have made it. Love to you, Polly. All right, this is a short one, and goes out to Phil Geist, because I think we both agreed to the sentiment of the title. I never knew how to pronounce obeyed. Sunday after Thanksgiving, I go east, she goes west. She got called into work. So we go from Thanksgiving, and this is a Christmassy poem. Spinning punk rock records for my mother on Boxing Day. It's the day after Christmas, and I need to head north. Before I go, we sit by the stereo in the family room. I put on the Minutemen for her. Buzz or howl under the influence of heat. 1983, I tell her, Los Angeles. She closes her eyes and listens, and she nods along. I put on Fugazi, Waiting Room. DC, I say, 5 years later. She says she can hear how it sounds like other bands I like. And then I play the Wipers. Is this real? We hear Return of the Rat, talk about Nirvana and the Beatles. Mystery plays. When it gets to the chorus, my mom says, beautiful. She is so right. All right, and then I'll send this poem out to Ed Field, the poet Ed Field, wherever he is. That's another short one. Saturday afternoon. In my bathrobe, sipping coffee, reading Fat City, and listening to Chopin. As snow piles up out in the streets and the cars spin wildly out of control, and I think of the poet Ed Field, go with the turning willingly, give in. Chris Collins pointed out how my poems lately have been having a lot of spacey kind of stuff going on in them, and so I'll send out some spacey poems to Chris up the hill. Orbital perspective. Isn't it pretty? The neutron star collapsing, balancing over the black ocean, and our dandelion fields full of the strange cosmic beasts we like to give names to. I couldn't stop looking at the shadow of us there. It looked different after our difficult, lonely journey. I too felt I was destined to join in a great experience. It was freeing in a way to be so arrogant in my beliefs, to lean in fully toward that kind of dimensional realism, navigating the change and the changeless, the universal and particular. A trash truck woke me from dreaming. I parted the blinds a bit, and out my window, I noticed the sky down in the gutter, a flowing atmospheric river. Sometimes, but not all of the time, I can find the music. I'm glad I could be here. I'm happy you're here with me. Another shorty. Emergency. In Youngstown, Ohio, a single letter falls off of a sign that hangs next to an elevator and ends up providing what might be wisdom. The sign now reads, "In case of emergency, use the stars." Thanks, everybody. Between order and adventure. For days now, I've been walking around this place, my foolish brain, for some strange reason, repeating the melodramatic phrase, "My heart is on the line." Last night, I fell asleep to the sound of steady rain. This morning, I woke to birdsong. I like this planet with its surprises and little envelopes of dreams, our proximity to the phases of the bright fixed stars. I will say that it does get a little cold here on occasion, but then I've got my anxieties to keep me warm. The point is not necessarily to hold on to the sanity, so much as to embrace it when it does take hold. Everything that has been made is not necessary. I'm one of the ones who just wants more and more. Three more poems. Shade Tree in Summer. If I'm honest with myself, I'll own up to that I can't always make sense of living this life. My existence here on this spinning sphere, the day and night, and then day and night once again, the heat, then cold, then heat, the grief and the suffering followed by this moment with you under this shade tree in some little park, in some little town here in the Middle West. Not too hot in the shade, cool enough for us to get close and stay there. Archipelago. There is that feeling in the distance there, off a ways but still approaching, like a boat making its way from one island to another, with a speed that is difficult to determine. But I know it. I have had it, or something like it, before, I think. It is something like the sense that time is too fast, that I'm not working on what I should be working on, or else that I'm not doing near enough to make things better, that I'm failing worse. Some nights, I'm the only one on the dance floor. And sometimes, it seems like I am on fire, and no one notices, and I don't know how to put it out. But something has found me. I am only alone and misguided if I don't consider the burning and all of the flames for what they mean or represent or signify from above. A light in the darkness. Thanks everybody for listening. Taking a cue from John Dorsey, I'll end with a poem by our friend Bart Solarchik. Sunrise through a hospital window. The city I love, the city that bore me, burning with memory, calling me home. Thank you.
So we are going to take a break, and what's going to happen here is there's going to be a break so that we can get the poet's photograph. Then we'll come back, and there will be an opportunity. There'll be some opportunity before the open mic and after the open mic for you to buy a book from one or more of the poets here tonight. They have some amazing work here. It is great to have you all here. This was a really special reading tonight. It was very strong. It was very compelling, so heartfelt, and so much just beautiful work. I'm always just amazed at what people are doing. So thank you all. And I want to tell you who's going to be here, not next week, but on August the 13th, because this series runs the second and fourth Tuesday of May, June, July, and August. So on August the 13th, we will have Nancy Krygowski, Mary Soon Lee, Bob Pajic, Bonita Lee Penn, and Michael Sims. And that should be amazing. We hope you'll all come back. We are going to have an open mic. I want to say something about the open mic. The open mic works when the poets who get up read two pages. It does not work when someone gets up, as Jimmy would say, and attempts to read Hiawatha. All right? We don't look well upon that. Okay, so a word to the wise. If you happen to have brought Hiawatha with you tonight, okay, it is better for you not. You are welcome to get up and read two pages, maybe a page and a half, but there are other people who plan to read two, and this only works if everybody kind of follows the rules. Yeah, please. Okay, so I'll just keep that in mind, and remember you're dealing with somebody who used to teach junior high and is merciless. Okay, people here can attest to that. Okay, so thank you for a great evening. We're going to do, and Jen will be doing the open mic, so if you'll just we'll take a little break, and if the poets will kindly come up here, and what an evening. Thank you all.
Thank you, okay.
Yeah, poets come back, meet in the back of this room.
So Jason, John, Leslie, all you folks, back of the room. Back of the room.
Hey, so great to hear you.
So good to hear you again, Leslie.
You have a little one. Oh, my God. It's so
No, we're going to go on the corner. Okay.
We only have two people for open mic, so four available slots for someone to share their lovely work. Just saying. So we'll start in a few more minutes, but if someone wants to come and sign up, here's your invitation. What should I say? Joan didn't mean to scare you away. We're a very welcoming group. we're hanging out to hear the open mic. So, you know, come on by. I see some poets I would love to hear read. No pressure, but. All right, so we are going to go ahead and start, and it is the Night of the Mats. So, first one, Matt, he spelled it phonetically for me, but even with the phonetics, I'm afraid I'm going to mess it up, so my apologies. Lutwin. Yeah, Matt Lutwin.
Hi, everybody. Okay, so I'm going to read three poems. Each one is from sequences I'm working on. Each sequence has 10 poems. They're just numbered. And the form is four stanzas, three lines each, separated by asterisks. So the way it looks like they're like individual units, kind of collaged top to bottom. Anyhow. this is the first one for the first sequence. A random page with your name on it that continues on to the next plurality of movement. That it could come from a place of love, shape the syntax of an opening hand. That in a way we both came up with these words, dispensed their limitation, and just danced. That it may not hit the nail on the head. Instead, give us room. Friend, perhaps we don't need the words. All right. So this is the seventh poem from, I think, the first sequence. I don't want heaven or hell. I want to dance until I can't. Life is never abstract. We moved words around, which became erotic, as if there was nothing behind us. I could just sit here and think about it, paper and glue and grounding, considering the space in which we do this. All right, and then the last one. This is the second poem in the third sequence that I'm continuing to work on. What was cathartic made do, united the people. Our common cause was right in front of us. The heart has not teleology, but passion, cardinal, canary, chrysanthemum. Long ago, they talked about the long view. I love you, naturally, in the composition. What distance of matter, if any, controls exposure? Okay, thank you.
Matt number two, Matt Ucia, come on up.
All right, these are two short ones, written on and about the days that they're named after. Independence Day. Celebrate freedom with every hot dog. Set off Roman candles in the alley like the Constitution isn't full of 3/5 compromises and electoral colleges. Take a victory lap for a war our grandparents won. Forget how landowning white dudes like me were once the only ones who could have a say about anything. Because no victories are absolute, just a renegotiation before the next fight. Enjoy every parade and picnic, since the feeling of slowly losing freedom is another thing we don't like to think about. Or maybe just spend the day naked in an air-conditioned bedroom in a country that often seems like too much. Thanks. This one's called Sitting in Motor Square Garden the Morning Bart Solarchek Died. Escalators drone under the cathedral top. Motorists whisper, waiting for mass or driver's license renewal. There was a whole world behind Bart's minimalist lines. His oldest memory, impersonating a race car driver on a tricycle in a backyard in Mount Oliver. If his ghost was here, he'd say, I guess life goes on. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Don and Joan. And thanks again to Hop Farms and to all of our wonderful readers. We'll see everyone on August 13th. All right.